Right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm Assistant Secretary of the Research Branch here in the Parliamentary Library. Welcome to Budget Week and welcome to the Parliamentary Library and to the first of our two budget seminars. Excuse me. This morning's seminar aims to take a broader overview of the issues affecting the Australian economy before we all turn our focus to tomorrow night to the more specific details of budget measures and so forth. So to do this, I'm delighted to have with us two of Australia's most eminent economists, Professor Warwick McKibben and Dr. John Edwards. Both have very long and very distinguished CVs, and I could probably spend most of the hour to come running through them, but that would cut into their speaking time. So some edited highlights. Professor McKibben is Professor of Public Policy and Director of the Centre for Applied Macroeconomic Analysis at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the ANU, and I hope you don't have to say that title too often. He's a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Social Sciences, a Distinguished Fellow of the Asia and Pacific Policy Society, a non-resident Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, a Professorial Fellow at the Lowy Institute for International Policy for a decade from 2003. He served for a decade on the board of the Reserve Bank of Australia until July 2011. He's been a member of the Australian Prime Minister's Science, Engineering and Innovation Council. Dr. Edwards is a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute, adjunct professor with the John Curtin Institute of Public Policy at Curtin University, and a member of the board of the Reserve Bank of Australia. In his rather diverse career, he served as Director for Economic Planning and Development in the Kingdom of Bahrain, Chief Economist for Australia and New Zealand for the Global Financial Group, HSBC, Chief Advisor, Financial Markets of the Australian Treasury, and Principal Economic Advisor to the Treasurer and then Prime Minister, Paul Keating. And, of course, has been a political and economic journalist in Sydney, Canberra and Washington. So both of our speakers will speak for about 10 to 15 minutes and then we'll have the second half for general discussion. So I encourage you to save up questions as they're talking. We'll leap into the discussion at about half past. On that note, could I invite you to welcome our first speaker, Warwick McKibben.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and thank you to all the Jonathans involved in organising this workshop. I prepared a presentation for 20 minutes, which were the guidelines, so I may go a little bit over the 10-minute limit. What I want to talk about today, though, is give you a broad picture of what's happening in the world and what it means for Australia, which means 15 minutes is probably the minimum amount of time I need to do that. So the idea here is just to set the scene. The question is, where are we and where... The state of the world today depends on a lot of different factors. There's a lot of shocks that we understand will be coming our way. We don't know when, but it's pretty clear that will be. And there's a lot of shocks that we have no idea about. And so the whole theme of this presentation is the world is highly uncertain. I don't think you should make decisions on budgets thinking that you can forecast the future, thinking that you can get it right, take a risk with the Australian economy, which previous treasurers have done, and got it completely wrong. So I then want to dig down into what drives growth in the world economy, and we do know about demographics, and I'll talk a little bit about the global demographic picture. Issues to do with productivity, and the final key driver of economic growth is investment or capital accumulation. So the key theme of this section is really what's driving growth in the world. And then I want to touch on what I think are two of the very many policy risks. One is the issue of fiscal sustainability. At the moment, I think we're at a very serious point in the global economy where the Fed is starting to raise interest rates, monetary policies are being renormalised, and there are many countries and many households and many corporations that have the balance sheet in a very precarious situation. And I'll touch on the ever-interesting question of what will President Trump do next. And it does have big implications for Australia. So the world in which we're in is a very interesting period of time. We've got this fundamental transformation going on. We have new economies, China, Brazil, emerging into the global economy, India, with millions and millions of consumers and firms, and the world is being transformed by this adjustment. And this has been going on now for at least 20 years. And then at the same time, we have a lot of technological disruption. So there's a lot of disruptive forces, all of which in the long term I think are very good, But in the short term, there's a need for policymakers and corporations to understand what this implies and to adjust to these changes. At the same time as you have these big global forces, you have individual countries that have not really changed their institutions or their policy settings since really the Second World War. And so we have this very large shock hitting the global economy, and we have these long-term problems in these individual economies which haven't been dealt with. And Australia was very fortunate, we're in the same position as most other countries, but we had the China boom, which gave us an extra 10 years to hopefully spend on relevant adjustment but probably wasted. So what we're seeing then are these really long-term changes, and it's impacting on rigidities in most advanced economies, and policymakers are really focused on a business cycle. They're putting in place monetary and fiscal policies to deal with the fluctuations in the economy that you normally see, when in fact the deep problems are structural, and there hasn't been anywhere near enough structural adjustment. So what shocks do we expect to see in the medium term? I'll talk a bit about the global demographics, because this is something apart from the fact there might be a pandemic or the demographic picture might change dramatically for reason of a war. But pretty much we can see what's happening with population growth and labour force growth. There is a big debate about where is productivity going? Is it slowing down or is it accelerating? As I mentioned, fiscal sustainability is a big issue. Climate change is a big issue. Whether you're a sceptic or not, there are policies being put in place in major economies which will fundamentally change the nature of the production and use of energy. So whether or not you're part of that story or not part of that story, or you believe it or you don't, the policies are real and they're having big impacts on energy producers like us. And there's always a chance that there'll be a pandemic. The reason I raise that is because I've actually done a lot of work on pandemics. And it's a very interesting way of worrying about the world. In the very short term, what are the issues? Well, we've got this issue of President Trump, very loose fiscal policy, a tightening of monetary policy. We've got internal contradictions in Europe. We've got a big structural adjustment occurring in China. We have some interesting policy experimentation in Japan. And there's always geopolitical tensions which are changing every day. So let's dig down now and just talk very briefly about what is driving growth. So let's look at the demographic change. What this shows you, these are the medium fertility projections from the UN, and the world is divided into different group blocks of countries over four different time periods. So if you look at the left-hand side, the world in 2010 to 2015, that's actual data, the world population was growing at roughly 1.2%. And as you can see, if you look right across all these countries, every decade later, population growth is less and less and less. Now, there's two things that are really interesting about this story. One is that, in fact, Japan, for example, and Europe have already entered a period of negative population growth. So that means that some countries' populations are actually shrinking. The labour force is actually shrinking faster than the population. The second thing that's interesting is that some countries have very high population growth rates and some have very low population growth rates. These asymmetries are really important for the way in which global trade and capital will move around the world over the next four or five decades. So this asymmetry in population is a key issue that I think is impacting on the global economy at the moment. Oh, I should mention, Australia's demographic picture looks remarkably good compared to everybody else. You can debate about big Australia versus small Australia, but we have quite a substantial population growth rate, as does New Zealand, because of immigration. So that's one of the key drivers. We expect a global slowdown in population. We expect asymmetries across countries. What about productivity? Well, this is the graph for global productivity in the blue line. So you have this wave of declining productivity up until the 80s, and then an acceleration of productivity, and then a slowdown since the crisis. What's interesting here is that most of the upswing has been driven by China. Most of the downswing has been driven by ever-diminishing productivity in the advanced economies, except perhaps the US, where there's this productivity uptick up until 2000. So here we have a question of what will happen in the future if productivity is trending down. If population is trending down, then you would expect economic growth around the world will be trending down. But again, notice the asymmetries. Some countries are slowing, but they've got very high potential productivity growth. So what are the alternative futures you can think about? Well, there are many. I mean, we can't really say what the world will look like in 10 years' time. What we can say is that we have got this negative productivity in the data that we're measuring. We've got technological disruption, which we can't find in the productivity data, because if you're innovating with technology, you'd expect productivity to rise, not fall. But the data suggests output per unit of worker input is falling. So there are both positives and negatives coming from the disruptive technology. It could be that it's not measured properly. That's always a possibility. It could also be that a lot of the productivity isn't in production. It's in end use, iPads for consumption purposes rather than technology for production purposes. And I've done a paper with a PhD student recently on some of these issues. Let me turn quickly to fiscal sustainability. This is the state of the world debt to GDP ratios in gross terms. And you can see that the advanced economies, the debt to GDP ratio has been trending upwards, jumped quite a lot during the financial crisis, and now is well above 100% of GDP. Now, in the advanced economies, this is really well in excess of what many economists thought was sustainable. 60% debt to GDP was the rule of thumb. It's built into the Maastricht Agreement that holds the Eurozone together. Of course, it matters what the debt is used for. If it's all being used for infrastructure and it generates a high rate of return, not a problem. If it's used for consumption and there's no asset on the other side of the balance sheet to offset the liability, someone has to pay higher taxes to finance the consumption that we've taken from the future to the present. The good news in this story is that the developing countries don't have a debt crisis as they had in the 70s. So all the debt accumulation has largely been in the advanced economies. Again, a big asymmetry. Those countries that still have a lot of growth potential are the countries that still have reasonable debt levels. Those countries that are slowing down are the countries that have the high levels of debt. When you dig down into the individual countries, this chart shows you the debt to GDP ratios by countries across the OECD. Each bar consists of three shades. The blue is the debt ratio in 2007, before the crisis. The red is how much debt was accumulated during the financial crisis. And the green is how much debt has been accumulated since the financial crisis. So the total, for example, for Japan is around 235% of GDP. So that's a very large number. If you look for Australia in here, you'll see Australia is down here on the right-hand side. When I did the data, this is a year old, it's 46.2% gross debt to GDP. Now, you may be concerned about net. Australia's net figure is below 20. But depends if there's a crisis, depending on who has the offsetting assets. I wouldn't count the future fund, for example, as an asset because that's already the liabilities of the public servants that it was created to fund in their retirement. So what you can see here again, very big asymmetry. Some countries have enormous debt to GDP ratios, particularly the European economies, Greek, Italy, Belgium, France. Some countries have very low debt to GDP ratios. So again, a big asymmetry in the world economy between the debtors and the not so heavily indebted. So what are the key issues then if you're starting today in this world where the Fed is tightening policy, renormalisation of world interest rates? You've got rising interest rates, and we've got, if you look forward, you're just trending forward from the graphs I showed you, low economic growth. High interest rates, low growth, when you have a lot of debt, is a recipe for a debt time bomb. Now, talk about time bombs. President Trump, he is fantastic for my research because no one knows what he's going to do, so people need to turn to economic models to do different scenarios. What if he does this? What if he does that? What if the Chinese retaliate? So from a personal point of view, this is a really good natural experiment. Economists like natural experiments. It's something that you can identify as exogenous and then you can test your theories with the data, and it's fantastic. From a moral point of view and an ethical and global point of view, it's a complete disaster. But anyway, so what are the key policies? And I won't go through these in detail. I've written a paper on this that was published in last year and presented at the OECD and in Washington. The immigration is actually a big story for US economic growth. Expelling something like 2.5% of your workforce, 20% of your agricultural labour force, is a big negative shock to the US economy. I won't touch on that here. What I'll talk about really is the fiscal stimulus, big cut in corporate and household taxes, increase in infrastructure spending, increased defence spending, and of course there's always the war with Mexico. And then there's threats of tariff increases. When we modelled this, we estimated the immigration and the fiscal stimulus would be about 5% of GDP worsening of the US budget deficit. That's 5% of GDP increase in a deficit in an economy where unemployment is now at 3.9%. And this is going to be very much like the early 80s, which is very, very interesting to see what this does to the world economy. So what does this all mean? And I'll stop here, and I can talk further in questions. What you'd expect to see and what you are seeing is a steepening of the yield curve. So US 10-year bonds have now gone through 3%. So you'd expect, by our modelling, at least 100 basis points at the long end of the yield curve coming from the tightening of monetary policy and the loosening of fiscal policy. You expect to see the Fed moving much more quickly because they're worried about inflation and being at full employment. And you expect to see a very strong US dollar. By our estimates, the US dollar would appreciate by about 15 to 20% relative to what it would have been as a result purely of the fiscal policy. What this means is probably not a problem for the US in the sense that they are growing and they are innovating and the US is the centre of the global economy, but it's a very big problem for countries outside the US that have large debt, particularly debt that's in foreign currency units. So if the US dollar appreciates 30% and your debt's in US dollars, that means that the cost of the debt has just gone up 30%. If you've got an external debt to GDP ratio of 100% and interest rates go up by 100 basis points or 1%, you have to give away a percent of GDP of your economy just to service the debt. So this is a very dangerous situation. So there'll be a lot of stress in the emerging countries, and in my view, it's almost certainly there'll be a major financial crisis in some countries, probably not in the US. So what's my summary? The future is unknowable, and scenario planning is a useful way to think about the future, but it's really not the way to set policy, betting that the future will look like a particular future that you want. The idea of policy should be not to set the levers just to manage day by day, but to have a framework that's very, very flexible. You want flexibility in the economy because as the world changes, you want the economy to be able to change with the world. And this is where a lot of advanced economies have got into problems. So you should be designing policies not on the idea that you can forecast the future, but on the idea that we need enough room that whatever happens, we're in a good position. And Australia's actually done a very good job with that. The two examples where I think we got it badly wrong was climate policy. If you go back to the Rudd-Gillard period, when they forecast the world would have a carbon trading system and we'd have a carbon tax and then we switch it to a carbon trading system when the price of carbon was $26 a tonne. And it turns out the European trading mechanism failed, pretty much, and price fell to €6 a tonne. Our entire framework fell apart. It was badly designed because it projected a world that didn't occur. And the second one is budget policy. To think that the China boom would last forever, and it turns out it didn't last forever, and you baked in spending programs and tax programs which required a very strong global economy, very high commodity prices, and then you find that that's not the case, that's a very, very dangerous world to enter, particularly if, in fact, we have a large economic shock. There's lots of papers that I've published on these topics, and that's my website, sensiblepolicy.com.
Thanks, Warren. Beautifully timed. John, over to you.
Thanks, Jonathan. So what I thought I'd talk about is what are Australia's current economic circumstances, and when we think about our current circumstances, what is an appropriate stance, appropriate stance of fiscal policy? You know, what's the right thing to be doing in terms of the overall magnitudes that we're going to see tomorrow night? And let's just at the beginning remind ourselves that we're in what is effectively a concurrent, quite strong global expansion, which, as Warwick says, may well get stronger when the US fiscal deficit contributes to what is already quite a rapid growth rate in the US. Just going through some of the components of GDP, we've had for the last since 2013, as a result of the Reserve Bank's monetary policy, we had a very large upswing in housing construction, which to some extent compensated for the decline in mining investment, but that's now turned negative. On the other hand, although it was widely said that the mining boom is over, in fact our exports have never been stronger in real terms, making a very big contribution, and also never stronger in nominal terms than they are right now. Our real problem over the last few years has been the expected decline in mining investment. The really good news is that business investment has come back quite strongly, up around about 7.2% over the last year. It's something we've been waiting around for a long time to see, but it's now occurring, and I think pretty certain that that will continue. At the same time, we've seen a very big rise in public investment, part of it stimulated by the federal government, not all of it, to the point where now, through 2017, public investment higher in Australia than it has ever been. A lot of complaints about the weakness of household consumption is not actually all that weak. It's not. It's a little bit above or close to the rate of growth of GDP as a whole, but it could well get stronger. There's real GDP through to the fourth quarter of last year, about 2.5%, but that reflects a fairly weak fourth quarter, with every likelihood that it will pick up through 2018 and 2019. According to the Reserve Bank, it'll be above 3%, and that seems to be a reasonable likelihood given what's happening with business investment. And that's also reflected in the NAB business conditions survey, which is stronger now than it's been for a while. Well, there's a lot of complaint about the decline in labour productivity in Australia, and it's true that in the most recent reading through to the end of last year, the four-quarter reading, it was negative. But I think we do need to take it in the context of an actual acceleration in productivity growth, which was arrested during the mining boom for labour productivity. Much more so for multi-factor productivity, because that reflected also the decline in capital productivity. And that too, over the last few years, has sharply improved, and that big decline in capital productivity that was initiated by the huge investment boom in mining has also tapered out. It's often said that we're seeing a big acceleration in the profit share of GDP, a decline in the wages share of GDP, and to some extent that's true, but you can also see from this chart that whilst it's true only to a small degree, that, for example, profits, the lower red line, have been higher as a share of GDP in recent years than they are now, and that while the labour share of GDP has fallen a bit from its highs during the 90s, it's only fallen by a couple of percent. It's an issue that we should be concerned about, but not perhaps too much. What's happening on wages? A lot of complaint about weak growth in wages, and that's certainly true, but it's also true that wages growth is now picking up, and that's reflected not only in the wage price index, but also in two other measures of wages. Seems little doubt that wages growth is picking up. And real wages are very, very weak, as you would expect, given the decline in the rate of growth of nominal wages. But on the other hand, they're still positive and likely to pick up as nominal wages growth picks up. Consumer price inflation, again, a lot of concern that inflation seems to be stuck in a very low band. In fact, inflation has come up quite a lot. It's already at 2% on all three measures, the headline and two analytic measures. And likely to continue to increase through this year, a little above 2%. We've seen very strong growth in employment, and particularly in full-time employment, through 2017 seems to have paused. I think highly likely employment growth will continue to pick up as we go forward, and that's what the forward indicators suggest. Real GDP per head, it's often said that Australian living standards are falling in terms of the customary measure of real GDP per head. Actually, we're continuing to see gains, not at the rate that we've seen them in other periods, but we are seeing gains in real GDP per head. I won't go through those sides or issues that may come up later. Let me just deal briefly with three issues that often come up in the kind of pre-budget debate that we're now in. One is the constraint of high household debt. The other is that we need corporate tax cuts to be competitive. And then I want to have a look at the impact of progressive personal income tax. Well, it's certainly true that our household debt in Australia, compared to disposable income, has increased quite sharply. Not as sharply as actually it increased earlier in the decade, in the 90s, but it has increased a consequence of the housing boom. It's worth bearing in mind, however, that because the cash rate is so low, the actual servicing commitments of households, their interest payments on debt compared to disposable income are lower now than they were, than they have been since around about 2003. So that there is actually room for interest rates to go up, and we'd still be short of the quite, even though we've got markedly higher household debt, the servicing burden on households would still be below where it was prior to the financial crisis. It's also worth bearing in mind when we think about high household debt, that high household debt is essentially households lending to each other through the medium of banks, and that's most vividly illustrated through the virtual equivalence of household bank deposits with bank lending to owner-occupied dwellings, more or less the same and have been for years. And also in respect of households, it's worth bearing in mind that household net worth is nine times bigger than it was when this long-running expansion commenced in 1991. Well, it's said that we need to have corporate tax cuts and urgently in order to remain competitive. And it's certainly true that at some point we may need to consider corporate tax cuts. I don't think there's any urgency, and the reason is that the numbers suggest that we're getting plenty of foreign investment. In fact, foreign investment through 2017, foreign direct investment through 2017 was higher than it has ever been. It seemed to be very vigorous indeed, whereas if you think that our corporate tax rates are uncompetitive, you would expect more outward investment, and in fact outward investment in recent years has been fairly feeble. So it seems to me that's not a very strong case. And looking at the totals, our direct investment never higher than it has was through 2017. Well, finally, before we come to consideration of the budget itself, I want to draw your attention to the impact of personal income tax. Personal income tax has been rising about three times faster than household disposable income. This has been so for a while, and of course that's the classic way in which for the last several decades or longer we have repaired budget deficits. It's the interaction of a progressive income tax system, which accounts for more than half of our total tax revenue, with rising wages, which always brings us back to ultimately to a surplus or balance. And that's exactly the operation that's been going on for the last few years. It's introduced a wider wedge between a household income, including income tax, and household disposable income, or at least a gross disposable income, which excludes tax. That taxes accounted for an ever larger share of household disposable income. Well, what do we expect to see tomorrow night? What is the appropriate stance for these circumstances? And to my mind, the appropriate... we should not take the view that the Australian economy is on its knees. In fact, it's reasonably vigorous. It's got low inflation. Growth is strengthening, but there's plenty of room for more growth and faster growth before we start to run into constraints. I think on the reporting so far, the key to this budget is going to be the removal of two commitments the government made 6 months ago in the MIEFO. The first was a commitment to projecting 1% surpluses after 2021. That commitment will be eased by reducing that ambition to 0.5%. In the MIEFO, and I think this is crucial, undertook to bank any favourable increases in tax or reductions in expenditure from the targets set out in MIEFO. In other words, were the revenue position or the spending position to become more favourable, essentially the deficit would be less or be turned into a surplus. Well, this seems to be the other commitment that the government abandoned, will abandon tomorrow night. And essentially what we're going to get is a set of tax cuts that result from the projections now being a bit stronger than they were in MIEFO. That's, to my mind, really what's going on here. And those are the keys also, of course, to the political strategy of the government. Well, now, it's worth bearing in mind, I think, that even though we're going to see tax cuts in the budget tomorrow night, it is almost certain, unless the government is vastly more radical than I expect, it is almost certain that tax, in personal income tax as a share of household income, will continue to increase over the next few years. Otherwise, it's extraordinarily hard to get to surplus, which remains the government's intention. Well, this then poses the problem of how one thinks about the tax cuts. Do they stimulate household spending? Can the budget be considered in that sense expansionary? And there are views in the market circulating to that effect. To my mind, we can only regard the tax cuts as cuts from a tax that that would otherwise be higher than it will be. It won't be a gain to household income, except in the sense that household income growth might otherwise have been worse had those tax cuts not occurred. And furthermore, I rather suspect this is taken into account in most official forecasts, that, for example, the Reserve Bank on Friday produced a statement on monetary policy with a set of forecasts about certainly involving household consumption, in which it seems to have mentioned the budget only in the context of the budget of India and the Congressional Budget Office of the United States. No reference to our own, and I think given that the Secretary of the Treasury sits on the Reserve Bank Board, given that there's quite a lot of interaction between the forecasters of both bodies, that we should take it that the Reserve Bank has made a judgment about the stimulatory effect of the measures to be announced tomorrow night, and given that the RBA has made very little change in its forecasts from the last statement on monetary policy, we should infer that the RBA's judgment is that the economic consequence of the budget won't be very great. Well, just to conclude, in my view, this is going to be a very mildly contractionary budget. There's no... that doesn't really trouble me. It would trouble me if it was... If it completely abandoned a path towards a... towards a surplus, but it won't. It won't. I think, as I say, we will continue to see tax rising as a share of GDP through to the 23.9% number indicated by the Treasurer. I would make the point that if it's possible to abandon commitments made 6 months ago, it would be unwise to place a lot of confidence in commitments made and renewed tomorrow night with respect to what will happen in a couple of years' time. It's interesting that, I think it's very interesting in the Australian budget that, and Ross Gittins has made a big point of this, and it's important, is that the government over the last, Treasury over the last two budgets has introduced a much better way of figuring out the amount of capital spending in the budget. And the capital spending is sufficiently big in the Commonwealth, mainly through its payments to the states for capital works. It's sufficiently big so that the recurrent spending in the budget is now entirely matched by recurrent income, and that all borrowing is for capital purposes. And not only that, if we continue in the direction we're going over the next few years, recurrent income will be considerably greater by several percentage points of GDP than recurrent spending. This is not a bad budget position to be have. This is exactly the golden rule that was initiated by the British Treasury, 20 years ago, that so long as you're balanced on recurrent, then you're not... And if you're then a little bit ahead on recurrent in terms of income, then you're actually making contribution to national savings rather than withdrawal from it. I don't think we're going to see much debate about the stance of the budget. What we're going to see is a very, very useful debate, I think, over the next few months on the rearrangement of tax revenue and the rearrangement of spending. It's a debate I'm looking forward to hearing. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Thanks to both speakers. We'll now move over to some general discussion. It'd be good if you can all sort of keep the questions reasonably short and refrain from sort of policy statements from the floor, just to maximise time for debate. I'll exercise facilitator's privilege by asking the first question, if I could. What's the? I've read a certain amount about a commentary about China being in a debt crisis, and given they're our largest trading partner, do you have can either of you comment on your sense of, are they really in a crisis? How severe or not is the Chinese debt position, and what are the implications for us?
Well, John's actually just told me beforehand he's waiting on China at the moment, so I'll let him go first, and I'll follow up if that is agreed.
Very good.
Well, that wasn't a pre-arranged question, actually. John, sorry.
Well, it's certainly true that China's got a lot of debt, and A lot of this debt is accumulated by state-owned, I mean, a vast preponderance of it is accumulated by state-owned enterprises. And but bear in mind, it's all owned to state-owned banks. And it's historically, it's been the way in which the Chinese government has conducted the industry policy, if you like, or supported the continuance of state-owned enterprises that would otherwise not be able to employ the number of people they do. Well, Chinese government debt in particular is not very high. Chinese household debt is not very high. It's just this. And Chinese private sector corporate debt is not very high. Not a leading problem in the views of the rating agency. The only area is this very large debt, I think 78% of GDP, equivalent to, owed by state-owned enterprises to state-owned banks. On the most recent data I've seen, this is coming down, or all of it's not going up. In the event, it's well within, if necessary, it's of course well within China's gift to eliminate this debt and to recapitalise the banks, if it had to. But it doesn't have to. And it'd be unwise to do so before it's reformed to state-owned enterprises anyway, because it set itself up for another cycle of subsidies delivered through debt rather than through specific budget allocation. So that's my take on it. It's not getting worse. In some respects, it's getting better. There is a hole there with state-owned enterprises.
So I agree. I would just add a couple of things. One is that the gap between Chinese productivity and the frontier in many sectors is extremely large. So the amount of potential growth left in China is very, very high. So if you know the debt level stays roughly constant and the Chinese economy expands at 6-7% a year for a number of years, these imbalances can grow out of. The second issue is that China has enormous amount of foreign exchange reserves, trillions of dollars. They can easily pay for this externally. They can pay for it internally. It's an internal issue. And so I agree with John that it's usually the American commentators really want China to fail. Mm. And it's interesting, when I go to Washington, when I visit Brookings, they're stunned that someone would think China's potentially going to be able to grow for decades and decades and decades and be a positive for the world economy, which I actually do believe it is. The politics is very different. But the economics is that you know you get a lot of poor people and make them wealthier, and they innovate, and a lot of the innovations going on in Chinese industries is potentially labour savings because of the demographics in China is very negative actually as you go out further. So there's a lot of investment in worker replacement for future decades, and so I just think the investment profile, the education investments that are going on. Yeah, there's a lot of positives in China from an economic point of view. It's hard to imagine how that could fall over, but at some point China has to transition from having people with economic freedom to allow the people to have political freedom, and not many countries have actually been able to manage that. Maybe Singapore is an example that you could point to, but many others, you end up running into the politics of political roadblocks.
So, open to the floor. Any questions for the panel? Thank you.
Oh, hi. You both talked about the productivity story quite nicely. And if you sort of read the newspapers, you probably think we're going into a period of capital for labour substitution. But it looks like capital productivity is going down, labour productivity is going down in Australia. What's the sort of multi-factor productivity story globally? And is there an illusion there?
Well, it's an open debate. I mean, you've got people like Bob Gordon who thinks that there is no productivity growth coming after the toilet and the automobile, that's it. There's nothing else coming. I find that very hard to believe. I mean, if you go into Silicon Valley and you talk to the venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, you get completely the opposite view. And actually, we're writing a paper on singularity, which is the idea that at some point technology becomes self-inventing, and so that end up productivity growth comes from productivity growth. And there are people in Silicon Valley whose business model is based on that. Bill Nordhaus has done some work at Yale looking at what does it mean, are we in a point of singularity, and he's suggesting we are at a point of takeoff. So it is possible that some of these technologies will actually lead to massive dislocation. And what's interesting in the dislocation is traditionally the innovation has been low-skilled workers being displaced, but with the artificial intelligence that's being developed, it's actually repetitive work like accountants, like doctors, like people that can be replaced because they're doing stuff that you can automate. And so there is potential, these two schools of thought, and we've held conferences at Brookings where we have the different schools of thought arguing with each other, and they're both very compelling. So I don't know what the answer is. The answer is you don't want to bet on one and it turns out the other one is what actually happened. So that to me is an enormously interesting point in history where we are. But I think the big problem is we don't have the regulatory frameworks in place to deal with these sorts of innovations that we're seeing, whether it's innovation in Bitcoin technologies or blockchain technologies. And I just think the whole institutional structures we've built aren't fit for purpose in the current world in many, many areas. John, I think, might want to say something.
So, yeah, well, I just want to query a bit about the openness of Australia to these new technologies. I mean, I don't know that there is a real problem in Australia in our accessibility to or openness to new technologies when they arrive. I mean, we do seem to adopt quite quickly. Whereas the US is a very, you know, supposed to be, but in practice is a very constrained place. So I'd be more inclined to think that we have less of a problem in that respect than the US does.
Just look at the banking system in the US. Try and cash a check. Yeah, they still have checks.
They have checks, they don't, and they use money. And I mean, pretty well all their airports are publicly owned, something that is now in Australia inconceivable. Mm.
So, James, and then
James.
Yes.
Thanks for that interesting talk. We often see in economic commentary, and you've kind of touched on this a bit, sort of distinction drawn between government investing in capital infrastructure, which is sometimes a subject of good, and government running deficits or whatever to in recurrent spending, like schools and hospitals, or with a sort of subtext of running a deficit in this area is bad. But having a educated and healthy population is just as much as an investment as a new railway or a port is, as far as what's going to generate government tax revenues down the line. So what's the rationale, really, for economic rationale for being worried about recurrent expenditure on education as opposed to one-off expenditure on a new railway?
This is a very nasty kind of question that you hope never gets raised, because I'm not sure there's a very good answer. if we think of human capital as being, similar to physical capital or substitutable for it sometimes, why should we regard a physical infrastructure, and the financing of it differently from education? And I think you'd have to start making an argument just about the recurrence of it. You know, that it's wise to have things which, like education, which are which may be an investment, but which are a kind of recurrent investment. It's wise to have those things met by some kind of recurrent funding.
So I disagree. I think the fundamental difference is education has a social and a private return, whereas infrastructure generally has a social return. So you could be educated and you can just go offshore and make $1 million and you never return that to society, but the infrastructure assets are staying in Australia. So I think that's why the financing of the HEX approach to education, income contingent loan, is a good way to finance to get the equivalence, because there is a certain private return. You could do that with parental care, the day parental leave. I think you should fund it not through taxing companies, but you should have an income contingent loan so partners can take, either one or both can take leave, generate a HEX debt type thing for the family, which gets paid back over time, because the private return of having the child raised at home is good, but there's a social return to that as well, which is why we give discounts on the interest payments of that debt. So I think that's the way I would see the difference. Infrastructure does have a big impact on
sector-wide productivity if you do it right. So you have to actually have the right way of designing on the projects. Now, the World Bank study by Louis Servin, which was a meta-analysis of all infrastructure projects across time and across countries, found you get a 0.1% increase in productivity for every 10% increase in infrastructure assets. Now that's positive and that's real, and that's taking into account the bad projects as well as the good projects. So there's clear evidence that infrastructure should be publicly funded, and therefore you borrow against it because you generate a rate of return. But I think the education thing is subtly different, but the same principles apply.
Private businesses generate, to build the infrastructure, generate a pretty hefty rate of return from the government contracts as well.
Also, for the education providers and the schools and the teachers as well. I mean, the question is, do you want to generate the income and then how do you redistribute it? That's the key question. And both of them generate income and both need to be thought about in terms of redistribution.
Warwick, you mentioned the high likelihood of a financial crisis in the future. I'm just wondering what's the potential for that to impact Australia and what kind of policy tools could be used to lessen that impact?
So if you looked at all of the figures that I put up and also John's presentation, Australia is in a pretty good place relative to everyone else in the world and absolutely ourselves. We have a lot of reforms that occurred under the Paul Keating years and going through the Howard years of flexible exchange rate, independent central bank. We actually didn't have any government debt at one point. We do have some now, which gives us some vulnerability. But we're in a pretty good place. We could use fiscal policy if we need to, and there's still a little bit of room left for monetary policy. I think the regulatory framework is very good. That's what one of the 10 key things that got us out of the financial crisis was good regulation of the financial system. People don't like it, but the fact that we had distortions in the banking system, which meant monopoly profits going to the banks, meant that when we got hit with a balance sheet shock, it didn't drive them out of business. Some of that was good luck, some of it was actually good planning. And we're in economically in the part of the world where a lot of the future potential growth is. And so India, China, Southeast Asia, actually, Asian economies, that's a very, very big chunk of where future growth is going to come from. So I think we're in a pretty good place, but we may need to use fiscal policy cleverly, not wastefully like we did last time, but cleverly. And we could have some capacity with monetary policy, but not much. I think we cut rates too far, but that's John would disagree with that one.
Two things that you touched on briefly were, one was about the US rates, and I wondered if you had any comment about the effect of let's talk about another rate rise in the US, but also about President Trump restricting immigration. And I wondered whether there's any potential impact on the tightening immigration regime in the US for Australia, because as you mentioned, Australia is a fairly high immigration country.
Yeah, and this partly comes back to that previous question about human capital. What you're seeing is, and at the university, for example, I'm getting applications for PhDs and master's students of a higher quality than I've ever seen from a more diverse group of countries, particularly Islamic countries, Indonesia, parts of the Middle East. So that human capital which drove the US boom in education is being redirected to other parts of the world. My daughter's at Yale doing a PhD, and her classmates, several of them have gone on the market and won't stay in the US because they feel, because of their ethnicity, they feel they're being persecuted. So they're looking for jobs in Europe and Australia. So that over time has a very big impact on medical research, on all sorts of research, and that's a net benefit to the countries like Australia and actually the countries which have had long periods of brain drain in emerging countries. So it's very bad for the US, but actually it's like a redirection of human capital to other parts of the world, which could be a net over time quite beneficial to a lot of research and a lot of progress in the world economy. I mean, I'm an optimist in that sense, but it's very dangerous for the US to follow this sort of undercutting of the drivers of economic growth. You only have to look at Silicon Valley to see who's running all the startups. They're not ethnically born Americans, they're Indians, they're people from all over the world.
Since we are talking about human capital, immigration and innovation, I wanted to ask what are your views on the transition of the Australian economy towards a services-based economy, and how does that relate to productivity?
Well, that's this has already occurred. I mean, I don't know how much further we can go being a services-based economy, except, I suppose, to see a greater representation of services in exports.
Well, the 90s, for example, which we celebrate as the period in which both total factor productivity and labour productivity growth were extraordinarily strong. In that period, most of the gains were in services. And in fact, if there is to be a national gain, it pretty much has to come from services because the other sectors are so tiny compared to it. I don't think, and a lot of the things that Warwick mentioned, where you may be substituting artificial intelligence for functions that are currently carried out by human beings are in services. So I don't think we have a particular problem being a services economy with taking advantage of technologies which will enhance productivity. I don't think that's going to be a problem.
There is an interesting side point here. If you look at the disaggregation of productivity growth, it is true that it's very hard to measure productivity growth in services. And so therefore, if you're getting a shift from agriculture into services over time, you could be going from a high productive sector to a low productive sector, so the aggregate numbers might actually worsen rather than improve. And that's a big story in Asia. Zhong Wai Li and I have just published a paper on that, looking at the composition of productivity growth across the Asian economies. There's a lot of capacity in Asia for service sector productivity to rise sharply, and that could well be the next driver of growth in Asia.
Thank you. Phil. Can I ask a question about household and small business credit? So we had a chart up earlier that showed that household debts are at sort of peak levels, or the highest levels they've been in history. So I just wonder whether or not, so firstly, how important is that, the availability of credit to household and business for economic growth? And secondly, what is the potential risk from, say, rising interest rates or a housing price crash or the Banking Royal Commission, for example, and banks, you know, reducing credit availability?
So there's for every asset, there should be a liability. So the question is, who's owning, who's got the debt and who's got the assets? So if there is some sort of crunch, whether or not it's disruptive will depend on the behaviour of both sides of that balance sheet. John rightfully points out the amount of wealth that's been generated in the Australian economy, 11-fold increase since the 90s, means that there's a lot more capacity for Australians on average to sustain an adjustment in prices, but at the margins there will be people who will be hurting, and the question is, how will that be adjusted, how will that filter through the economy? I'm not uncomfortable with where things are in Australia. I think that we can manage that situation. But you know, I think we have to assume that Australian interest rates will be rising because our long end of our yield curve is driven by the global interest rate. And we're below the US 10-year bond rate now. So that means it's inevitable whether the Reserve Bank wants to or not. The financial costs that our banks face in the world economy will filter through into the housing market because they finance a lot offshore. So whether the Reserve Bank raises interest rates, it's inevitable they go up under the scenario that I painted, which may or may not be right.
Well, I think to a very large extent we can tether the housing rate here because of the well-known Australian preference for floating rate mortgages, and so that they're priced off basically 90-day bills, which are under the RBA's foot. But even so, I would think it highly likely that that say by the end of next year the cash rate would be, say, I don't know, 2.5. Or at least that's the way one ought to think about it. But even so, I think you'll find if you plug in 100 basis points on top of current mortgage interest rates, you're still ending up with household interest payments somewhat below where they were 9 years ago as a share of disposable income. So I think we've got rather more room than we're led to believe.
My view is that I would have, see, if I was on the board of the bank, I would have raised interest rates by now by 25 basis points. Because if there is an underlying problem we don't know, it would cause a disaster. It's good to know that this year rather than next year. And if it doesn't, then you know that people got the message that rates can change, and in fact they can readjust their portfolios more gradually over time. So I would have actually gone up just to see what happened and set a signal and get some data to see whether we do have a problem. Because I agree with John, we probably don't. But we didn't think that when the US raised interest rates from 2004 to 2007 that the US housing market would blow up, and it did. We just didn't have the data.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're actually out of time, so we'll need to wind up there. I'm sure if our speakers will hang around for a few minutes afterwards if you want to have any other follow-up questions. Copies of all of the slides will be up on our website with the leave of the agreement of our speakers. I'll also just, before I let you go, I'll just draw your attention to these. This has the information for all the library's research products that support the budget consideration. The slides will be up there, and also we'll be progressively publishing a range of articles and analysis. Also, tomorrow morning, two of my colleagues from the economics section will be doing the traditional Navigating the Budget seminar, which is at 11 o'clock in this room as well. So I hope to see some of you there. And finally, could I invite you to join me in thanking our two speakers for a very, very interesting and optimistic, actually, discussion and presentations.
You're on the list to invite. 20 is the Monday, Tuesday.